numero 14.
Ja, hallo. Hier heute im Studio Felicia Herrschaft und zu Gast Karl Michael von Hauswolf, der heute Abend eben im Portikus eine Ausstellung eröffnen wird, und zwar Friedrich Jürgensson mit Karl Michael von Hauswolf zusammen, und zwar Audioscopic Research Archive Radar Works. Und dazu könnte man sagen, Friedrich Jürgensson, auf den sich Karl Michael von Hauswolf bezieht, war eben Philosoph, Maler, Archäologe, Linguist, Sänger und Dokumentarfilmer. Und er gilt sozusagen als Pionier der Transkommunikationsforschung, Transcommunication Research. Is this something you work on also?
It's not really something I work on. It's a concept that I use myself for working with audiovisual artworks.
Yeah.
But then, of course, this gets connected with Jürgensson's and other EVP researchers' work.
Yeah. And to say something more on Friedrich Jürgensson, what I will do now first in German, and then we should start talking in English. Also Jürgensson gilt als der Entdecker des Tonbandstimmenphänomens, und er hat eigentlich auch eine Opernausbildung. Und beim Versuch, eben seinen eigenen Gesang auf Band aufzunehmen, fand er eben 1959 erstmals dann unerklärliche Einblendungen von Geräuschen und Stimmen auf den Tonträgern. Und er begann dann diese Stimmen, die meist eben eine Mischung aus Deutsch, Schwedisch, Italienisch, Englisch und Russisch mehr oder weniger zu ihm sprachen, dann wiederzuerkennen und daraus dann Aussagen bestimmten Persönlichkeiten zuzuordnen und diese zu transkribieren. 1960 empfahl ihm dann eine dieser Stimmen, das Radio beispielsweise die nicht von Radiosendern belegten Frequenzen als Medium für seine Forschung zu benutzen, deren Ergebnisse er 1964 dann unter dem Titel The Voices from Space und später als Sprechfunk mit Verstorbenen veröffentlichte. Als Jürgensson 1987 in Schweden starb, hinterließ er dann unzählige Notizen und mehrere hundert Bänder mit seinen Aufnahmen. Und Karl Michael von Hauswolf arbeitet eben seit den späten 70ern an der Schnittstelle zwischen eben bildender Kunst, experimenteller elektronischer Musik und Performance. Und seine Installationen sind dann ähnlich eben auch Versuchsanordnungen, die nicht so sehr am fertigen Werk, sondern mehr an der Aufdeckung akustischer, visueller und gesellschaftlich-kultureller Phänomene interessiert sind. Und Hauswolf sucht sozusagen oft die Zusammenarbeit mit Künstlerkollegen, und da wäre die Frage, inwiefern er sich dabei auf Jürgensson bezieht, denn er hat 2000 zum Beispiel eine umfassende Retrospektive des Gesamtwerks von Friedrich Jürgensson in den Verkfabriken Stockholm ausgerichtet, sowie die zweite Göteborg-Biennale 2003 kuratiert. Und was jetzt genau im Portikus zu sehen ist, besprechen wir jetzt hier in diesem Gespräch und versuchen gleichzeitig den Sprechfunk mit Verstorbenen aufzunehmen. So, we play now another track, 47, the dialogue with Vincent van Gogh. Or is it a dialogue?
No, it's just more like a short recording that he thought was the voice of Vincent van Gogh. Yeah.
Okay, so we hear it.
Einspielung 36.
We are back from so this kind of Sprechfunk mit Verstorbenen. Why is it called like that? And why did what is this? Please, maybe you should explain first what is it for? What kind of installation did you make in the porticus? Because there is a radar Gerät in the porticus, and that has a function, and you make pictures with the radar. And the question is this because Jürgensen was a painter too? Or how does this come that you work with radar as kind of...
As a medium.
As a medium or as for pictures?
Yeah. Well, it comes from quite a while ago when I started to work with audiovisual matters. I mean, I work a lot with sound and sound installations, and I always thought that for myself it's just as easy to work with sound as it is to work with pictures. And then I just wanted to show a relation between sound and vision. So I started, like many other artists, to work with oscilloscopes. But
yeah.
I also needed another type of concept for working with this oscilloscope. So what I did was that I recorded the sound of electrical systems around the world, and then I showed those frequencies on the oscilloscope and also played it in loudspeakers. And then I claimed that one might be able to hear trapped souls or voices trapped within the electrical systems, and this was for me not really to prove that there was like anybody living in the electrical system. I just thought it was like an amusing idea, and at the same time it was also the idea of showing that a lot of things are possible that you cannot see, you cannot hear. I mean, people should not take everything for granted, like, and be so materialistic, because there might be other things around that you don't know anything about. And then this gradually, of course, when you work with these kind of pretended voices in the electrical system, other people come and say, yeah, well, this is a work by Friedrich Jürgensen or by Konstantin Raudive or other people that has actually, as a science, worked with trying to record voices from the other side, from dead people. So this is how I sort of stumbled over Friedrich Jürgensen's archive. It was really just by accident that this archive came over me, because he died in 1987, and his archive was standing in south of Sweden, totally untouched, and totally, you know, nobody really cared about it. So what you see in Portugal now, it's another installation by me. It's a radar installation, which, of course, the radar is also, you could call it a sound installation, but the radar frequencies you cannot hear because they are ultrasonic frequencies. Mm. So it rotates inside the porticos, and you can, and it tries to, the radar scanner tries to deal with the room of porticos. Of course, porticos is too small to contain a radar, so it gets a little bit sort of freakish. It doesn't really feel comfortable in there. But I show this kind of radar screen on a larger with a projector, so you can actually sit in there and maybe detect very strange phenomena that might be inside of the porticos. So on. So this is basically the same kind of thing. You might see things that you normally cannot see, but you could see it on the radar. And it's a certain way. And I've been setting up this radar system in places like Bangkok and New York and other exhibition areas. And mm-hmm. it becomes sort of a pseudo kind of scientific work with building up a radar image archive. So for me, it's the way of opening up for like the senses and like showing, you know, I mean, the world is not what you think it is. It might be something else in there. But Friedrich Jürgensen, and in Portugal, we show the entire body of work from Friedrich Jürgensen's recordings from 1959 to 1987. And there is also a selection, it's a CD produced with a selection of these recordings that he recorded. So there you have the connection with my sort of artistic work and then Friedrich Jürgensen's scientific work. For me, a person like Friedrich Jürgensen, I mean, I consider him also an artist. I mean, the way he was like dedicated to his work and to just year after year work with these kind of recordings, despite what that people maybe was like, they were maybe anti his ideas, or like he worked against a lot of people that doubted on him, but still he was like working just like an artist. You just go on with your work, and I think it's quite amazing what he did. But he had also, of course, as mentioned before, connections with the art world, because he was a painter all his life. But he was very uninterested in various kind of modernism, abstract art, or he didn't like anything of that. He painted kind of realistic paintings, watercolors of flowers, but also portraits of people. But and one amazing story is that two popes has been sitting models for Jürgensen in the Vatican. In really? 1952, it was Pius the 12th, mm-hmm. and then in the 60s, another pope. So, and these paintings are hanging in the Vatican. So he was like, you know, he was also doing archaeological diggings at Pompeii. And he also had a short career as an opera singer. He was also a documentary filmmaker, so he did all these kind of things at the same time when he was doing this recording. So his soul is really, he's really like a kind of artistic guy and a fantastic artist, I think. That's why. Mm. Like a Renaissance kind of person. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Maybe another one. So it's number 50. It's number 50 now.
I hear something else in it.
Oh. Oh, that's the wrong CD.
That's some kind of pop music in there. But I mean, you know, in these recordings, I mean, there's a lot of recordings, and I mean, sometimes you hear this kind of, you know, choirs like singing, and you know, you never know, maybe it's like some pop music over there on the other side as well, you know.
Yeah,
you never know, they have a death metal band or something, you know, playing on the
yeah, this kind of sounds behind it can be maybe. How did he know, or how do you know that it's really coming from outer space or from someone who is dead? Or
yeah, I mean, I don't know it. I can just go for what he's saying, and I mean, he knew that it was something very strange in these recordings. But it was just also in 1959 when he started to do this, he couldn't really understand what it was. And he contacted other people, and they said, well, it must be some other kind of, you know, radio transmissions or something like that, you know. And he couldn't figure. But then one night when he was recording, he actually heard his own dead mother talking to him.
Mm-hmm.
Then he realized, aha, this must be, you know, voices from the other side, really. And, of course, a lot of people during the 60s and the 70s, they contacted him, and it became quite a, you know, a news, of course. I mean, if somebody can sit there and record the dead, you know, this is like super fantastic. And as Jurgensen said himself, you know, when somebody asked him, how could you have made all this work all these years? Why do you do that? And he said, well, you know, if you are about to solve one of the great mysteries of life, you know, death, then you don't take this work and put it in a shoebox under your bed, you know. You just continue to work with it. But I mean, people have been trying to contradict him and to see, but nobody has been able to show what these voices actually are. So I cannot sit here and say these are voices from the other side. But I would rather say, yeah, you know, yes, I believe in that, than to say, no, I don't believe in that, because I think it's boring to say no. It's more interesting to be of a positive nature for these kind of things. But still, no one has been able to prove what it is, and nobody has been able to prove that it isn't, you know, voices from the other side. So this, yeah, this still has to be, you know, discovered.
It's in a balance, maybe.
Yeah.
And that's how you balance always new structures with sound in an exhibition space, maybe, right, if you put a radar into.
Yeah, I mean, not always. I mean, I work a lot with other things too, but when it comes to audiovisual things like these ones, I would like to have a nice balance between the sound and the visuals. Of course, with this radar installation, you cannot hear the sound, but at the same time you're very much aware of the fact that there is a radar in there and it's working, because you could see that on the screen. It's rotating all the time and scanning the place all the time, sends out this high frequency tones.
Yeah, it's scanning.
Yeah. I mean, it also, I mean, a little bit gives you an idea of, because, I mean, we live in a world of mobile phones and high-frequency signals, like, all the time, you know, bouncing around and you know, really working as some kind of a virus in your own bodies, and you don't really know what all these frequencies are actually, you know, doing to you. And it's also like this embedded in this kind of installation that, you know, you have these kind of frequencies everywhere, you know, but you don't hear them, but, you know, you never know what they're doing to you. I mean, radar frequencies are, if you stand very close to a radar, it can make a guy sterile, you know, so, you know.
Really?
It's a good, instead of using a condom, you know, you could just buy a radar, you know, and there you go.
So it's you will have always still this problem, or only for the moment?
I don't know if it's temporary, if it's like chronic.
Okay. This is like maybe the problems the swinger club people have who were here before or won't have. Maybe we should talk on... because I have some material here on Swedenborg, the Geisterseher, and maybe is there a long tradition in Sweden to have this kind of working on what is in between what we can know and what is a spiritual or a psychological problem or a system?
Yeah, I mean, yeah. I think we have all over Europe, not only West Europe, but also the East.
Swedenborg is really popular in
Russia,
America,
and so on. Yeah, yeah. Sweden, there's a big Swedenborg society in America, and not only Swedenborg. I mean, in Sweden we have had like artists, like painters, like Ernst Josephson, and these painters who has been like, you know, working with these kind of spirits and so on. And there is a tradition of like this kind of medium tradition of detecting spirits, you know. But that's not only, it's not like a Swedish phenomena really, it's just I think it's a phenomena that goes all around the world in various types and forms. And Swedenborg of course was it's a fine example of this kind of religious man that connects maybe his visions to angels and to other kinds of phenomena that was going on. I mean,
and how does it go? That someone like Kant had this had because of this kind of occultismus a deep feeling of desire to be in contact with Swedenborg, and because of Swedenborg's saying no to Kant. How can we say this? He just refused him.
Yeah.
Kant wrote in a way this critical of Kritik der reinen Vernunft as a reaction on this being not part in this Swedenborg.
Yeah. Now Kant was quite critical towards Swedenborg's visions and to that type of also that I think Swedenborg was too much of an artist or a writer. He was too fictitious, you know, for Kant. I think Kant needed a little bit more of a little bit more science than theology I don't think Kant. I mean, he didn't believe in what Swedenborg really saw, you know. And and of course, it can be like difficult to do it because you have to have these kind of experiences yourself.
Yeah. And what do you think is in the way people want to have or to be in contact with the other side of our being? Is this something that they reject God in a way if they just show what's going on? That there's something going on which is not part of where we would be.
I mean, I think in terms of Friedrich Jürgensen, he was not a man of God. He didn't believe in any kind of religion at all. I mean, he rejected all kinds of religions, and I think it's a very typical way for now to if you. And maybe you could actually have that as a critique against Friedrich Jürgensen, is that he was very scientific about his work, and he needed to prove that there is life after death scientifically. And of course, to do it scientifically, you have to come up with evidence. And I think it's very typical for nowadays how people work and you know how society works, is that you always need some kind of evidence for everything. Otherwise, it's not tolerable. And maybe I could also have that as a critique against society, because it's not everything that you could actually have evidence for. You could just believe something as well. I mean, and that could go for all right, I think. But society is, with its secularization, it's sliding very much towards these kind of ideas of proof, evidence, square, and 1 + 1 = 2. That's it, you know. I mean, and maybe in a society like this, where everything is just on the edge of like falling apart, you know, people needs to have something very firm and tight to hold on to. Otherwise, maybe they will just fall over you know, walk around on the streets being afraid all the time. It's this. So I think, and of course, I mean, everybody wants to know what's happened when you die. You know, it's like it's been going on forever. You know, like what happens when you die? And somebody says, yeah, well, you know, you come up to God or somebody. But I mean, since people don't really, you know, believe in God, you know, so much. I mean, what they still want to know what's going on, you know, because you still have the idea that a feeling that, well, when you die, you can't just really like die, you know. I mean, something must happen because life is so complex and beautiful, you know, that, you know, something must happen. So people want to have some kind of answer to that. And maybe Jürgensen has an answer to that, and I don't know. For me, he was just a fantastic artist that produced a fantastic body of work.
Yeah. Okay, we hear number 43.
32.
German,
unsere Orchester,
Swedish,
alle unsere kulturellen Einsätze.
Ja. Wir haben ein Swedish.
Sehen. Wir werden die Aufgabe tragen, die geistigen Menschen.
And do you have an explanation for this kind of rush always behind?
Well, Friedrich Jürgensen used, apart from like the first years, but like in the, from the 60s and so on, he used radio technology to be able to make this kind of recordings. And this recording, I mean, you hear like a whispering voice like really far back, and in front of it you have these kind of oscillations, which comes from, he very often tuned in the 1485.0 kilohertz midwave radio frequency length. And that was, it's called the Jürgensen frequency, actually. And he was using, in between stations, this kind of noise, this kind of radio sound wave noise areas. And it was there that he could actually make this kind of, there he was investigating in this phenomena. And so, of course, you always hear this kind of, you know, it's these layers of various types of sounds. You could also hear like normal radio programs, but then in the back there he managed to, you know, find something there, and that you have to listen to this like several times, like quite loud sometimes, and to actually, you know, hear what it is. And but he was obviously had a very good ear for that kind of thing, because there's a lot of noise on these tapes. And and the reason why he could tell that it was something else was because these voices always used as like a polyglot kind of way of speaking, that he used one word is in Swedish, one word is in German, one word is in Russian, one word is could be in English, and they have this kind of combination of languages, which of course nobody else speaks. But I mean, who speaks these kind of languages, right? Well, only then, or according to him, people from the other side, right? So that's how he could, you know, first hear this is one of the voices, and then he was of course trying to detect who it was, you know.
Yeah.
So he could, I mean, there's recordings that he claims is like Vincent van Gogh and, you know, Hermann Göring or whatever, you know, that came around, you know, in his world, you know.
And
Krishnamurti, there's a tape of Krishnamurti after Krishnamurti died.
Yes, yes. Oh, Annie Besant, the leader of the Theosophical movement after Madame Blavatsky, you know, he has this kind of, takes up this kind of records, this kind of people.
Uh-huh. Okay. Big orchestra. How did he get this into the other side, into in das Jenseits?
Was this track 39?
39, yeah. Mm-hmm. Or 40. No, it was 39. And why is he always saying Einspielung Nummer?
Number whatever. Yeah, because this CD that we have made is actually Friedrich Jürgensen's own selection of voices and recordings that he did, because he, before he died, he planned to release an LP record.
Yeah.
But then this never happened because he died. But he made the tape, and he made the selection, and he also made like the description of like what he was and so on before he died. And when I was going through his archive, I found these tapes and these descriptions of what was on the tape. So it was easy for me just to make a CD release out of it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and tonight you will have your own LP release in the Weserstraße number 5 together. Not together. Is this on one LP? You work with Felix Kubin. Well, and you, or how is it?
Well, me and Felix Kubin we've been sort of doing projects at the Städel Schule. So it's actually some of the students, yeah, art students at Städel Schule, who plays the record.
Yeah,
we are just sort of instigators and kind of you know,
teach them how to do it.
Well, it's more like a collaboration, you know.
Yeah,
I mean this kind of teaching stuff, you know. But
yeah,
I'm more into collaboration, so I just have an idea, and then we do it sort of together. So Felix and his student has one side of this LP, and me and the students that was working with me have the other side. So it's actually their record. I'm just sort of the, you know,
mediator.
Yeah. So it's them, but it's very nice, and I think the Städel Schule is actually one of the nicest art schools, you know, in the world.
Yeah, that's right. It's really good school, I think. And
so we have a party tonight. There will be some DJing, and there will be some playing of this record, and it will be, you know, yeah.
Yeah, this is in Weser Street number 5, and before there's the opening of the porticos of your exhibition. And to come back to some different influence, because this weekend the Utopia Station will be take place in the TAT, in the Bockenheimer Depot, and you were part in the Utopia Station in Venice, and you made you shredded a book on the Thomas Mann's book on Utopia. And how was it? What is your impression on how the Utopia Station functioned in this big exhibition, this Biennale from Venice?
No, I think it was one of the the places that actually functioned really well, you know, in this very large exhibition as it was. I mean, it was maybe you could even say it was too large, but. But I think it was good. It was divided up into various curatorial areas. And I think the Utopia Station, I mean, not because I was in that particular show, but I mean, it had a very, it generated a lot of energy, and people were like talking to each other, people were helping each other out. And it was like, I mean, when we were working, it was like really hot, you know. It was too hot really to do something. But, you know, it was a very good energy that came out from there, and from due to the curators that they were able to direct this kind of big Utopia Station. I thought it worked really well, and And the curators was also quite open to flexible in this way, because we sort of changed our thing. We expanded a little bit, and everything was sort of in some kind of a synchronization that I really like in this you could call it a little bit of a chaos too, of course. But it's as an experiment, I think it worked really well.
Yeah. And you made new papers out of
it's because
are you using it, the paper?
No, I mean, the story behind that is that a little bit more than 10 years ago, me and my colleague Leif Elgren from Sweden, we, as a conceptual artwork, we founded a new country.
Ah.
Yeah, called the Kingdoms of Elgaland Vagaland. And we enacted all the borders between every country.
Yeah.
Like the no man land between every country. That's our territory.
Ah,
and we
okay.
started to do flags and passports and stamps and a constitution and everything like this. Huh? So now for the Utopia here, we were invited as with this project, the country project. And we said immediately, well, we're going to annex Utopia. We're going to occupy it. We take it into Elgaland Vagaland. So what we did was that we published a book, Thomas More's Utopia, but it said on the cover of that book, it said, with this publication of Thomas More's Utopia, we hereby annex and occupy Utopia. It's occupied by the kingdoms of Elgaland Vagaland. And then we also realized that Utopia is something that from a general point of view, it's sort of not really usable. It's something that is, as we say today, utopic. So we thought, well, why don't we change that? So we took all these books that we printed and we shredded them, and then we made new papers from these books, just so that you could actually use the books with writing maybe a new utopia on it, or a poem, or whatever, make a drawing, or use it, maybe you could use it for toilet paper or whatever. But really, so we just put that the whole concept of utopia into some kind of a practical situation again.
Are you influenced by your family and the way you just try to find maybe this kind of utopia place or new territories or things like that in art? Is this something which has to do with your kind of socialization maybe?
No, this country, it probably has a lot of things to do with me as a person, or with my colleague Leif Elgren, but it also has to do with the fact that we think nationalism and nations are outdated and quite, it's of no good. I mean, it's a ridiculous situation to have these kind of borders that we have nowadays. I mean, maybe we could understand a little bit from an ethnic point of view that some people want to live together and because they speak the same language or whatever. But I mean, from a political, it's only like a political structure that makes these kind of borders that we have. Like something is the Sweden and Norway and Denmark and whatever. And we find that quite ridiculous. So it's actually a critique against the national state and nationalism overall.
Mm.
We think that's stupid, really.
Yeah. Yeah, so your work should be really should be connected to what Rax Media Collective is doing, because they have this warehouse project now in the TUTS to work with asylum seekers and their memories, and they will be part and discuss things in the Utopia Station this weekend, and next week they will make a presentation on how asylum seekers just wrote their memories into a warehouse book where they where they have pictures like a toothbrush and ashtrays and a barfoot, red barfoot, and things which remind them on their migration. And this is against this idea too of being having borders or being into one or being not allowed to migrate to some,
or being in a situation where you cannot actually go anywhere, which is also happens a lot of times with asylum seekers, the people that actually come from you know, war-ridden countries, and they come maybe to Sweden or to Germany or whatever, and they sit in this kind of place, you know, maybe for a couple of years before they can actually even enter Swedish society. And I think it's from a mental point of view, psychological point of view, it's a terrible situation. And we did this experiment just when the kingdoms of Helgeland, Vargaland, where we celebrated 10 years, we did an experiment that where 10 citizens, because we have something like 700 citizens now, but 10 of us, we went, including Jens Hoffmann, a curator, and Carsten Höller, a German artist, we went over to on a ferry from Stockholm to Estonia, to Tallinn.
Mm-hmm.
And on the ferry, when we came over to Tallinn, we hid our normal passports, Swedish passport, German passports.
We hid them away. Ah, so okay, yeah. In the sea, yeah.
Yeah, well, not really in the sea, but I mean, we just hid them somewhere, and, you know, in the cabin or whatever on the boat, you know. So, and then we tried to enter Estonia with our Helgeland Vargaland passports, and of course, they our country was not recognized by the Estonian government, so it was a problem, right?
Yeah.
So they stopped us. And then they were interrogating us, and then they called in the security police, and they started really hardcore interrogation.
Yeah.
And we were stuck there for like 8 hours, just like interrogated.
Yeah.
And then they threatened us to, you know, put us up in jail, you know, and everything, because we were like illegally there, you know. And our aim was to go, that they were going to send us back on the boat, and then back to Sweden, and then we're going to come back to Sweden and show the passports there too,
yeah,
and not entering Sweden, because Sweden hasn't recognized Helgeland Vargaland either. So then we would be trapped on this boat like forever, or as long as we didn't produce our normal passports. But what they did in Estonia was that they confiscated our Helgeland Vargaland passports, and after a while they actually threatened us so much that we had to show them our real passports, and then they just sent us back on the boat. But these hours that we were there in this kind of, I mean, it's, you can't even compare it to the feeling that people, asylum seeking people have, but you can get a small feeling of how it is actually to sit there and just not knowing. Maybe you have your children with you or something like this, and you don't know what is going to happen, what is going to, you know, where are you going to end up, and it's this absolutely terrible situation.
Yeah.
Yeah. So yeah, no, it's these kind of projects I like a lot.
Yeah. So would you say in the way this kind of radar works? Has this, because radar is normally used on the wide sea for military action, as for orientation. So it's in a way it's not determinate. It's undeterminate how it works. But how you use it, you change a little bit the connotation of it, maybe.
Yeah, well, basically, I just changed the way that people think about normals. I mean, you can also see it happened very fast when for instance, the Soviet Union was just falling apart into, and then divided up into Ukraine and White Russia and like everything. You know? It happens like that, and it's just and with the radar works and with that those kind of works, it just shows that nothing is stable.
Yeah.
And you cannot be sure about anything.
Yeah.
You could just believe in something, because everything is, well, I mean, philosophers has one way or another, and also science with beginning with Einstein and so on, they proved that matter is not a stable entity. But of course, I still sit on this chair, right? It doesn't fall apart. When I say fall apart, it doesn't fall apart. I still sit on this chair.
Gravitation is working.
So yeah, gravitation is working. But I mean, everything is sort of unstable anyway. And this goes with nation, countries, everything that's around you. And I find that quite interesting. I find it disturbs me that people are walking around and have that this kind of false self-confidence about, like, you know, how good we are and how perfect we are and how we're going to go somewhere and do some. I mean, people like George Bush and these kind of people are quite, you know, terrible, I think, because their ideas is that their ideas are perfect, and they are ideas that this kind of stable situations, which is not, you know, it's on the contrary.
Mm.
It can be totally, I mean, Texas can, tomorrow it can just say we want to be independent, and then you have a civil war in USA, just like that.
It's interesting. Oh, we have only 10 minutes left. So you have to tell something. Here, I can read it so short in German. Also, wie gesagt, die Banalität dieser Botschaften aus dem Jenseits beeindruckt mehr als das Jenseits selbst. Aber Jürgensson brachte eine ganze Lawine in Bewegung durch seine Veröffentlichung. Tonbandgeräte, Rundfunkempfänger, später Fernseher und heute Computer sollen Empfänger für Botschaften aus dem Jenseits sein. Das Rauschen auf diesen Geräten war im Grunde nur eine Art plastisches Material, in dem sie Stimmen bemerkbar machen konnten. Would you say there is a relation to the art context? If you be an important artist over many centuries, has this to do something with this kind of working with the other side of things, with the Jenseits? Is there a connection?
I mean, artists has always been working with fantastic stuff. I mean,
yeah.
And what Jürgensson is doing is kind of, you know, it's also fantastic. I mean, a lot of other, I mean, most work, artworks that I like are like fantastic work, even if it's like a monochrome painting or if it's a video work or a video installation or like a project and so on. That it also they always reaches the and crosses over the line of reality into something really fantastic, you know. And it's they can also produce events. I mean,
yeah.
Writers has always, I mean, some writers and artists too, and we sort of claim that, you know, you make art also to make something happen.
Yeah.
And what is happening, sometimes we cannot control.
Yeah.
So it's this is of course the connection with Jürgensson's works and any other artist's work, is that it's the notion of this fantastic, you know, ideas and matters. It might not be you know, real today, but I mean, in a couple of years, it's a reality for most people.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's kind of unfugitiv, to be unfugitiv, as things can be. Has this a relation to art?
What do you
because
mean?
Because the other side, das Jenseits. You understand Jenseits? The other side.
Yeah. Okay. If it's the other side. Yeah.
Yeah. And is there another word for it?
Maybe not. No.
Maybe not.
In Swedish, it might be.
Okay.
Yeah, no, the other side is good.
Das Jenseits and the other side has the same status, in which it is not be impressed by what we are doing. It's always, I think, something else. And it's a way. Yeah. We have the possibility. Artists have the possibility to be unfugitiv, untransitoriness.
I can see your point. I mean, artists is
untransient.
Artists are privileged. They're privileged to cross over these kind of lines and to use that kind of, which normal. Other, I mean, if you call art, you know, art, if it's a job, you know, then if you have another job, it's like very difficult to do something except the things that you're doing. But an artist are always privileged to cross over those kind of lines. But that also means that artists actually have a quite a stronger responsibility of what they're doing too, so they don't, you know, let things out that maybe could be sort of really harming other people. It's a much larger responsibility to work as an artist than it is to work as a science technician or something like this.
Yeah. And there's a video installation.
I can tell you a story that in 1986 I visited a place called Alamut in North Iran. Yeah. And this was when Khomeini was still alive and it was war with Iraq and so on. I wanted to go there because in the 11th century there was a guy living at Alamut called Hasan-i Zaba.
Yeah.
And he was the master of the assassins, which is the it's the forefather of assassination.
Yeah.
So I went to this place to, because it's a cult kind of place, right?
Yeah.
And hardly many people has been going there.
Yeah.
And I did it as a kind of an artwork, and I did a documentary film and took photographs and everything like this. But when I came back to the hotel in Tehran, the Swedish Prime Minister Olof Palme was just assassinated on the street in Stockholm.
Yeah.
This kind of connection, what you do as an artist, and then if it has anything to do with, you know, the connection
real
to
political life. Yeah.
Yes, I mean you can't control it as an artist, but at least you can be aware of the fact that things, very strange things, can happen when you work with art.
Yeah. And how Jürgensen, when Jürgensen died, something happened.
One can see that on the poster that we made for the Porticus show, and also on the CD here and everything, is that there's a photograph, a black and white photograph of a guy that resembles Friedrich Jürgensen. And the story is that he, when he died, he contacted a Swedish medium and told this medium that put on the television set on my funeral day at 1 o'clock on channel 4, which is inactivated at that time, and I will try to show myself on the TV screen. So this medium and her husband put on this television and then a camera in front of it, and then something happened on the television at 1 o'clock around it, and they took this photograph. So the photographer claims that it's a photograph of a dead Friedrich Jürgensen from the other side. So it's quite a fantastic story, I think.
Yeah. Yeah, and you really made a lot of reconstructions of it. But had you really a kind of real meeting with Jürgensen?
I never met him personally, no.
And no. I mean, now with your Red A or
no, I don't work with that. I mean, I don't try to prove anything about with my art and so on. I don't make this kind of recordings. I don't do this kind of tests. And it's for other people to walk into that area. I just show Friedrich Jürgensen's work, and I've never tried to sort of contact him or anything like that. Maybe I will one day when I don't have anything else to do. I know the technique, and there are several other techniques too that one can use. So it's not these are just Jürgensen's techniques, but there are other.
Is it possible in the exhibition to use his tapes and recording things, or is it only like an installation?
No, it's only an installation. But of course, my aim is to have this material so that other people that are interested in his work and in this kind of electronic voice phenomena works, that they could do research with this. Of course, I mean, it should be available for these kind of interested people, but right now we just have it as a body of work display, retrospective, really.
Yeah. Okay, so I think we should what is tonight? The party. We should genau, jetzt, also ich dachte, ich wollte jetzt eigentlich nur sagen, wir freuen uns auf die Party, we will enjoy the party tonight and the opening, this is what I wanted to say.
Okay.
And thank you very much for coming, Karl Michael von Hauswolf. And the opening is tonight in the Porticus, and then there's a party with a record release from Felix Kubin and Karl Michael von Hauswolf in the Weserstraße number 5. Okay, am Mikrofon verabschiedet sich Felicia Herrscher. Oh, your telephone. Okay.
Maybe it's Jürgensen.
Yeah, maybe it's Jürgensen is calling now.
Einspielung Nummer 14. Einspielung Nummer 14.